Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. In October 1957, the Soviet Union shocked the West by launching Sputnik, a little silver ball that circled the Earth every 90 minutes or so, emitting a beeping sound that seemed to taunt the U.S., which had not yet launched a satellite into orbit. Sputnik launched the space race, though, and our determination to land a man on the moon by the end of the 1960s. But we knew very little about the human reaction to spaceflight conditions at that time. In fact, we didn't even know if humans could survive being in space. So both NASA and the Air Force embarked on a crash course to acquire the scientific and technical knowledge that was needed to achieve that goal. And this drive proceeded on several fronts, including experimental aircraft that flew into the edge of space, like Chuck Yeager's X-1, and also medical research using mice, monkeys, and chimpanzees aboard what were basically World War II ballistic missiles. But there were many other types of tests, including centrifuges and rocket sleds to test human reaction to high G-forces, and also high-altitude balloons. Some of these tests were literally death-defying, not just because the effects on the human body were unknown, but also because many things could go wrong and sometimes did. A few of these pioneers, like Yeager and, of course, the Mercury astronauts, became well-known, but there were other lesser-known space pioneers who were every bit as brave and on whose achievements the successful space program was built. My guest today is one of these pioneers. He's a retired Air Force Colonel Joseph Kittinger. In August 1960, he rode a helium balloon to 102,800 feet, well into the stratosphere. That's nearly 20 miles up near the edge of space. And then he jumped out. It was a skydiving record that lasted 52 years until 2012. Colonel Kittinger was recently profiled on the PBS program American Experience as part of a show called Spacemen. Colonel Kittinger is joining us today from Tampa, Florida. Welcome, Colonel.
Welcome. I'm from Orlando, Court, but it's nice talking to you.
Okay, well, close, Central Florida. And we have a station, WMFE, in Orlando, so everybody in Orlando will get to hear this show. Appreciate you being on with us. Can we call you Joe?
Absolutely, please.
That'd be great. I guess the place to start, then, is with the balloon flight itself, and then we'll get into what led up to it and how you got involved. But I think it was the third in a series of high-altitude flights in a project called Excelsior. Why don't you tell us about that project?
Well, Court, first of all, before I do that, let me tell you that the Air Force started space research way before NASA was even thought of. I worked for a visionary by the name of Dr. John Paul Stapp. He was convinced we were going to go into space and people working on rockets, but nobody was really working on the human factors. And he knew that man would go into space, so he started space research way back in the early 50s. The first program that I was associated with him was with zero gravity, because he knew that when you put man into orbit, that he was going to be in zero G, and we had never really done any research to find out if man could survive a prolonged zero gravity experience. So I was the project pilot for Dr. Stapp on the very first zero gravity program that we used, where we put somebody in the back seat of a airplane, and I would go up and do a parabolic trajectory, and that was really the start of the program. And then Dr. Stapp knew that we were going to go into space. It was going to be in a very small, confined quarters. It had to develop the life support systems, the communications, the astronaut selection, all of the things associated with human factors putting a man into space. And he started a program called MANHIGH. And the purpose of that was to come up with a small, confined environment with all the life support systems that we would have to anticipate for the manned space program. And I made the first flight on that project. There were three flights made. I made the first flight in 1957, which was before NASA was even formed. And we gathered information on how to design a spacecraft that was used later by NASA when they started designing the Mercury program. So Dr. Stepp was leading the research for human factors way before NASA was even invented. And then there was another area that Dr. Stepp knew that we had to look at, and that was when we go into space, man was going to have to get outside of the spacecraft. We had never done that. And the other objective was we had people flying at very high altitudes, and we needed a means of escape. So that developed the program Excelsior, which you mentioned. And I made three jumps on that program in 1959 and 1960. I had a great team of people that were my people that assisted me, engineers and airmen and civilians and officers that had 13 men on my team that did just a phenomenal job, and they had the same goal that I did, was to gather research. In the three jumps that I made, and the last jump, of course, as you pointed out, was 102,800 feet, and we demonstrated that given the proper protection, that a man could, in fact, work into space, because I was in an open basket all the way up and all the way down, free-falling. And then we also came up with a means of escape from high altitude by using a small drogue chute. And by the way, Court, today, every ejection seat in the world uses a small drogue chute that provides stabilization during the descent. And this is something we developed back in 1959, 1960, and is still being used today, which makes us all very proud of, that we contributed to the safety of aviators. But it was all because of the foresight and the vision of Dr. Stepp that I was able to do these interesting programs that led us into the space program.
Yeah, I definitely did want to talk more about Colonel Stepp later on and how much of a visionary he was back at the time when people weren't even in the Air Force in particular, weren't even thinking about these things. And part of the driver for the research you were doing, as you kind of alluded to there, was also not just looking ahead to the requirements of space and the survivability of conditions in space flight, but also to pilot ejection, because the jets were getting faster and faster, and there was a fear that people were going to be basically ejected out and killed on ejection or cut in half by parts of the plane and that kind of thing. So some of the research you were doing for him, I know, was leading in that direction, too, for trying to gather information that would feed into the design of ejection seats and so on. Let's get back to talking about Project Excelsior, which you said, Joe, were three high-altitude flights, and then on the first one was pretty sporty. I gather that things didn't go quite as planned, so why don't you describe that first flight?
Well, the first jump was from 76,000 feet, and when I got there at altitude, I couldn't stand up. My kit that I had on my rear end that held the oxygen equipment, the regulator, and the camera, and the instrumentation, and so forth, was stuck in the seat. And I had a heck of a time getting out of the seat. Now, finally, I did. And in the meantime, as I was struggling, I started a timer running. And the timer was supposed to be pulled when I jumped from the gondola and go off 17 seconds later when I had velocity, sufficient velocity to deploy the drogue chute. Well, what happened was my fighting to get out of the seat, I started the timer going. And when I jumped, instead of free-falling for 17 seconds before this small drogue chute opened, it came open 2.5 seconds after I jumped.
Mm.
And lacking sufficient velocity, it just wandered around and wrapped around my neck, and it could not deploy. So I ended up falling pretty rapidly, and I suddenly started turning to the right, and I stopped it, and then I started spinning to the left, and I stopped it, and then I had a violent spin to the right, and it was so violent I couldn't pull my arms in. I had an altimeter on my left wrist, a time watch, and I really wanted to look at that, but the centrifugal force was so great I couldn't pull my hands in, and I became unconscious, and I came to at about 10,000 feet when my reserve parachute opened. It saved my life.
Wow.
But what it did, Court, it demonstrated why we were doing the project, because pilots are not skydivers. Pilots and astronauts don't have skydiving training, and they would spin violently just like I did. I was there as a pilot and an astronaut, not as a skydiver. So that first jump demonstrated why we should be doing that research. The second jump worked perfect. We corrected all the problems. That was from 75,000 feet. And then the third jump from 102,800 feet. And on the way up on that particular jump at about 40,000 feet, I discovered that my pressure suit glove in my right hand was not working. We had never put a man into a space environment without a protection of his hands and feet. So I really wasn't actually positive what was going to happen, but I knew that my hand was going to swell up and be painful. But I opted not to tell the people on the ground, because I knew if I told them, they would make me abort the flight.
Mm-hmm.
And I was concerned that somebody would cancel the flight if that happened. So I didn't tell anybody. And I just kept going. It ended up that I could not use my right hand because it swelled up twice its normal size. So I did everything with my left hand. We'd planned on that eventuality that something could happen that I could only use one hand. So we were prepared for that contingency. When I got to altitude of 102,800 feet, and by the way, one of the questions was why 100,000 feet? Well, that was the altitude was our goal. That's where we had airplanes would be flying very shortly. That was an altitude that was fairly close that the astronauts could escape from disabled vehicles. So my goal was 100,000 feet. Actually, the balloon took me up. The highest the balloon could go with the payload was 102,800 feet. So I was there about 11 minutes as the balloon drifted exactly over the spot that they wanted to jump from. And it was fascinating looking out at the world, which was, I could see 450 miles at that altitude. And, of course, Earth was 20 miles below. It was a fantastic sight. And then, of course, as you looked up, the sky got darker and darker until overhead it was just as black as night. So it was fascinating looking at this, but then it was also very hostile. If something happened to the pressure suit, you'd be dead in a few seconds.
Sure.
So space is not only beautiful, but it's extremely hostile to a man. And by the way, the altitude I was at was about 5 millibars of pressure, and that's the same atmosphere that's on Mars. So it was very, very close to a Mars environment where you'll have to be protected by a pressure suit at all times. But after 11 minutes, it was time to jump. I was prepared. I didn't hesitate. I had a great team. I had great equipment. I had confidence in myself. And I was ready to go. I went through a 43-item checklist, stood up, said a silent prayer, pushed the button to start the cameras, and I jumped.
Yeah, and this time you were able to get out of the seat. You weren't stuck in the seat.
Yeah, no problem.
They'd worked that one out.
On the third jump, we corrected the problem.
Well, I know, for one thing, being a fighter pilot and now a test pilot, in effect, and having jumped twice before, you had that experience, but were you still, I mean, this was a good deal higher than the other jumps had been, and, I mean, you really were at the edge of space, and nobody had ever done anything remotely like this before, and so were you just totally focused on the procedures and the mission, and you looked around and thought, my gosh, this is a beautiful thing, or was your heart pounding? Was your mouth dry? I mean, were you basically realizing, I might not live much longer? I mean, how was your feeling internally as you just about jumped?
I knew I was jumping into the unknown because nobody had ever done it. As a matter of fact, the previous altitude jump was about 42,000 feet. We were quite a bit higher than that. So there was always the unknown. But I had trained extensively for a year and a half, Court, and I had confidence in myself. I had gone through it 1,000 times mentally. So when it came time to go, I was ready. I was completely prepared, and didn't hesitate a second. Now, during the jump, I was there as a test pilot. I was there to gather information. And all the way down, I was talking into my tape recorder. I was gathering data. I was talking about the control that I had, how my pressure suit was working, all the physiological monitoring aspect of it. So I was extremely busy during that 4 minutes and 36 seconds. I had an altimeter and a stopwatch on my left wrist, and I could monitor that, so I knew what altitude I was at. And at about 14,000 feet, after 3 minutes and 36 seconds, I pulled the ripcord and opened the parachute. The rest of the jump was rather anticlimactic. When I got on the ground, my crew was there, and we were extremely happy. We had accomplished what we set out to do. We showed that man could, in fact, work into space. We show that man could make a escape from high altitude safely using a proper drogue chute. So we were very proud of what we had done, and we had a great team, and we were elated that things had worked out the way they did.
Let's go back, Joe, just for a minute to the jump itself and to the free fall. You fell for 4 minutes, 36 seconds in total, and in the first several minutes of that were through a very thin atmosphere. So what was the experience like? I've read about it, but I'm asking kind of rhetorically here. Were you aware of how fast you were going, and how fast were you going at the peak of your velocity?
That's a good question, Court. I forgot to mention it. I reached a speed of 614 miles an hour, and you have no way of knowing how fast you're going. There's no visual references. there's no way of knowing how fast you're going. As a matter of fact, Felix Baumgartner, who beat my record some 52 years later, he went 843 miles an hour, and he had no idea when he went supersonic. It formed a boom on the ground when he went supersonic.
I'll be darned.
But he had no idea because you're in a vacuum. You know, there's no air there. You're going extremely fast, and there's nothing there that you can visually see that tells you how fast you're going.
Yeah, there's no frame of reference around you.
There's no frame of reference whatsoever. He had no idea when he went supersonic. He had no idea when he went subsonic because you're in a vacuum.
Yeah, I would have thought offhand that you could feel yourself compress the atmosphere to the point that you made a boom. I would have thought you could feel that, but evidently you don't, so that's interesting.
He didn't feel it at all. He had no idea he'd made a sonic boom.
You know, you mentioned the drogue chute, which malfunctioned the first time, and I guess it was lucky it didn't end up hanging you since it was wrapped around your neck. But on this third flight, how does a drogue parachute, which is basically just a small stabilizing parachute, how does it keep you from spinning? I would think you'd be hanging from it and still maybe be able to spin.
Well, it gives you just enough drag to keep you from getting into a spin. It's about 10 feet above the center of gravity, so it acts as kind of a fulcrum to keep you in a stable position. And it worked perfect. And 2 years after Felix jumped, there's a gentleman by the name of Alan Eustace, by the way, from Orlando also. He made a jump from 10,000 feet higher than Felix, and he used a stabilization parachute, and he was perfectly stable all the way down. He also went supersonic and did not feel it at all.
So you said you didn't. There's no air around you, but as you fell further toward Earth, the atmosphere does steadily get a little denser, and as it got thicker, the air got more where you could feel it. Did you feel any heat? Did you begin to build up like a meteorite would at all?
Well, the pictures show that the fabric on the pressure suit doesn't even flutter when you're going that speed. But at about 70,000 feet, you start to get a little bit of air so you can start skydiving. In other words, you're now getting some aerodynamic benefit out of positioning your body and your hands so that you can skydive.
Okay.
So you're right, that as the pressure increases, you then have the ability to control the body.
So that slows you down enough that you're not building up any heat on your body as you're going down.
As you fall, you slow down. As the pressure increases, you constantly slow down until the terminal velocity at sea level is 186 feet per second. So if you did nothing, you'd be doing about 120 miles an hour, which is terminal velocity for a body at sea level.
You mentioned that you jumped out at the exact pre-planned point so that would determine where you landed. But, I mean, there's wind conditions and different things can happen. Did the people on the ground know exactly where you would land, and were they right there when you came down?
I had a great weatherman, Court, that gave us the point we should launch from, and that would and take into account the winds aloft. The first two jumps were made in November and December, and I launched to the west of the jump site. And then in August, when I made the last jump, I had to launch from the east, and I drifted to the west. And all three times, I never missed the jump point more than a quarter of a mile.
Boy.
Because of the brilliance of the weatherman that I had. And so I was within a quarter of a mile of where I was supposed to be. But my crew could see, when my parachute opened at 14,000 feet, of course, my crew could see the parachute. And they raced to where I was and got there just about the time I landed.
Hope you didn't land on a patch of barbed wire.
Well, it was a desert.
Oh, yeah.
It was a white sands proving ground, and it was a desert, which is a nice place to jump. You don't have to worry about trees and barbed wire and water.
Maybe cactus. Anyway, you're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Colonel Joseph Kittinger, who was basically a space pioneer before the Mercury program got going, and he was someone who was a pilot, if you want to call it that, a passenger anyway, on a very large helium balloon. He went up in a series of high-altitude flights, culminating in one at 102,800 feet, well into the stratosphere, where he jumped out, skydove all the way down, all of this to try to gather information that would be useful in the space program and to some extent in Air Force operations as well. So you know, it sounds like this was 1960, Joe, and now we're, what, 55 and a half years later. Is the memory still really vivid in your mind?
Of course. It was the most exciting thing that happened in my life, and I still can go through every second of it. It was the most fantastic thing I did in my life. But it was only because of Dr. Staff, and it was only because of the great team that I had. I was just a lucky guy that got to do it. But we were doing research that was needed, and we knew that it was needed, and we worked toward that goal.
You set four records in that one jump. They were the highest balloon ascent, the longest duration drogue parachute fall, which was 4 minutes or so, the highest parachute jump, and the fastest speed by a human being going through the atmosphere. And as you mentioned earlier, at least in one case, the last two of those, the highest parachute jump and the fastest speed, were only broken in 2012, I mean, more than 50 years later. So you were awarded actually two Distinguished Flying Crosses, and that was pretty distinguished flying you were doing there. And at the time, you were profiled in Life magazine and National Geographic. At the time, did you have, and we're going to talk about Colonel Stapp in just a minute, because he was really the pioneer and the leader of this thing, and you were kind of working for him as the guy doing the action, so to speak, but he's the one who set it all up and had the vision for it. But did you have, given all that, mixed emotions at the time about all the acclaim you were getting right then, being on the cover of big magazines and so on?
Oh, no, I felt very honored that I was being honored the way I was. But, you know, we didn't do it for notoriety. We didn't do it for publicity. We did it for the research that we knew that we needed.
But, I mean, you weren't embarrassed about it. It was just kind of came with the job, I guess. So let's talk a little more about what led up to it, because you've mentioned Air Force Flight Surgeon Colonel John Stapp. And, boy, he was really the unsung hero, because you were a sung hero, to put it that way, because you were the guy who ended up on the cover of the magazines, but he was behind the scenes, and he was really a pioneer of aerospace medicine, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, going back, you know, years before even these missions that we've been talking about. You were a fighter pilot, and he basically caught his eye. I mean, tell us a little more about how he kind of picked you up and identified you as somebody who could work with him on Project Manhigh that you mentioned.
Well, really, Court, it started, I was an experimental test pilot at Holloman, and one day my boss called us all together, all the test pilots together, and said, there's a fellow out in the north area that, by the name of Dr. Stapp, that's starting a program on zero gravity, and I'm looking for a volunteer. Well, I immediately put my hand up, and I looked around, and I was the only one to put my hand up.
Whoops.
What have I done?
But, yeah.
So anyway, I went over there, and I had a conversation with Dr. Stapp, and when he explained to me what and how, why we were doing it, I was elated. That's how I first met Dr. Stapp, was volunteering for a program that he set up. And I made over 1,000 runs, parabolic trajectories, on the research that we did for that zero gravity, preparing the way for man to go into space. That was my start. And then from that, I found out about a year later about the Manhigh program coming along. I volunteered for that. And then I went to Wright Field when he got transferred with him, and I started studying high-altitude escape. And I went to Dr. Stapp, and we decided that was research that we really needed to do. And he was not directly involved with it, but he gave me the tools and the support and the finances that I needed to get the job done. I was just a captain in the Air Force. Captains can't do an awful lot, but I had a visionary full colonel that was helping me accomplish the research that I needed. And by the way, I forgot to mention that after the Excelsior program, I did another program called Stargazer Court, and on that one, I took up an astronomer and a 12.5-inch Cassegrain telescope. I went up to 87,000 feet, and we looked at stars and planets like man had never looked before. Here was a trained astronomer with a very powerful telescope looking out through the nothingness of space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the reason stars twinkle is because of the turbulence between us and the stars. When you get above the atmosphere, the stars don't twinkle. They're a source of light.
Mm-hmm.
But that program was a wonderful program, once again made possible by Dr. Stapp. And that was not really the last research program that I was involved with before I went to the Air Commandos.
Well, that's an amazing experience in itself. But, you know, on Colonel Stapp, he was doing stuff that he was a brave guy. I mean, he wasn't just a researcher. He was he used himself as a guinea pig. He was developing rocket sleds that were kind of rocket-powered carts on rails that would get up to tremendous speeds and basically look at the effect of G-forces on the human body. And his fastest rocket sled run, I read, was 632 miles an hour on the ground, and that was actually faster than your top speed falling from the edge of space. And this was on the ground in a vehicle, and then he stopped almost in a dead stop in a couple of seconds, practically blew his eyes out. He bled in his eyes and thought he was blind for a while. I mean, that's amazing stuff for a medical researcher to subject himself to. Quite a guy.
Well, Court, he was the bravest man I ever met. He knew physiologically what was going to happen to him on that deceleration. And by the way, I was in an aircraft right alongside of him when he did it. I had a photographer in the back seat, and I was there when he made that run. And he pulled a minus 41 Gs at that stop, and he set the limit for human deceleration on that sled run. But he was the bravest man I ever met because he knew what was he was going to go through. But he knew that that information was needed for the ejection seats that are coming and the high-velocity winds that people would be ejecting at low altitude. So he was really a very unique and brave individual. But he was one of those unsung heroes that you mentioned at the beginning of the program, Court. People never heard of Dr. Stapp because he didn't seek publicity. He was doing research he needed. And by the way, a book just came out recently about him called Sonic Wind, which is a great book that explains all of the research that he did. But you're right, he was an unsung hero, little known to the public, but well known to the people that were looking back at the history of our entry into space and the people that contributed to it.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, Joe, your flying career spans an almost unbelievable range of events and experiences. I mean, we've talked about a few of the peak ones, but there are even more. I mean, you were the first man to make a solo crossing of the Atlantic Ocean in a gas balloon in 1984. For a while, I think we're vice president of flight operations for Rosie O'Grady's Flying Circus there in Orlando. And then in 2012, at the age of 84, you got involved in the Red Bull Stratos project, which you mentioned earlier, in which someone named Felix Baumgartner broke your old record for a free fall from 128,100 feet. He was a little bit higher. But the Mercury astronauts and later the Apollo astronauts who went to the moon became permanent American heroes and the subjects of books and movies. They were celebrities, and you never really were, but it's no exaggeration. I'm just going to say this to you, to say that you're a living legend among aviators. So just really quickly, just in a few seconds here, looking back, how do you feel about it all? Has it been quite a ride?
Oh, it was a great ride, Court, and I was just fortunate to be in the right place at the right time and to be a protege of Dr. Stapp. I was a very fortunate man to have the opportunities that I had.
Well, Colonel Joe Kittinger, we're fortunate to have you on as a guest. Good to talk with you. I want to thank all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.